Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast that will forge onward even after that devastating time skip. It's August 22nd, 2019, and I finally beat Outer Wilds, so this show will contain a special spoiler section in which Kirk, Jason, and I talk about its incredible ending and the puzzles we solved to reach it. Before that, I talk about my Gears of War obsession, Jason and Kirk delve into Fire Emblem, and we go over all the news and game announcements out of Gamescom. We close it out with off-topic talk about Billions, Succession, and Kirk's music pick of the week. Let's get to it! And we are back for another episode of Kotaku Split Screen. I am Maddie Myers, and I'm also joined by Kirk Hamilton. Hello, Kirk. How are you?
Hello, I am fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, and even better because I'm also joined by Jason Trier. What's up, Jason?
Hello, the only podcast whose support rank is at an S. Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen.
Which means I think that means we need to have a conversation where we basically just argue and insult one another for like 5 minutes, and then we all just walk away with nothing resolved. And that means,
but weirdly, that levels us up from what I understand about Fire Emblem. Having a conversation about our disagreements. Yeah. Makes us stronger.
Yes, exactly. We're still getting to know each other.
I like that.
That's how it, yeah, it's always, there's this character named Hubert who's in my house who's like this totally evil dude who is just like super creepy and weird. And every single one of his support conversations is him just either threatening someone or outwardly being like, this is how I could kill you if I needed to. Or some other variation on that. And then it always ends with that person that he's talking to running away in fright. And then their support level goes up.
Yeah, that's funny. That doesn't surprise me, knowing what I know from the outside about Hubert.
About Hubert. So we will get into more Fire Emblem talk, but first a couple of things. First of all, I actually just want to plug something real quick, which is that Tim Rogers, the iconic Tim Rogers, the infamous genius Tim Rogers,
he and I
have started a new series, a new video series on Kotaku called Tim Teaches Jason Japanese, which is basically the two of us, we're going to play through all of Chrono Trigger in Japanese, and Tim is going to translate, and I'm going to learn and like try to read things, and it's been fun so far. We did an episode last week. We're going to do another episode this week, so check it out. We live stream it on Twitch. I think we're doing it every Friday, but it's going to be a little inconsistent for the next few weeks, especially because I am then going on paternity leave, as I announced last week. But the best way to find it, I think, will be just on the Kotaku YouTube. Look for Tim Teaches Jason Japanese for fun times. Nice. And then another thing I just wanted to address up front, those of you out there might have seen over the past few weeks a lot of dramatic articles about our company, GO Media, right? That's our company's name now.
I guess.
That's what I hear.
I was talking to someone, I think even my wife was like, what are you guys now? Gizmodo? Like every time I bring it up to people, they're always like, why? What is it? I just say Gizmodo just because it's easier because nobody knows what the fuck GO Media
half
is.
My friends still call it Gawker. Like I'm just, I don't even try to correct anybody anymore.
Yeah, that's probably for the best. Anyway, I know that like people are always concerned. We talked about this when the Hogan stuff was happening, and then when Univision layoffs are happening, and it feels like we have to talk about this over and over again. But like short version is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Kirk and Maddie, but I think it's safe to say that the three of us will keep podcasting no matter what happens. Even if our company exploded tomorrow, we would find a way to keep Split Screen going in some form. So if tomorrow you see the news that Kotaku is dead or GeoMedia has exploded, just like look on our Twitter feed and we'll probably be like, hey, here's where we're going to go with our podcast next. There'll always be, we're going to keep podcasting, right? Right, guys? Is that
yeah,
the plan?
With ham radios after the apocalypse, we'll
if
be
we
there.
If we need to, yeah, ham radios. Yeah, man, we'll be like the three dog.
We'll be cranking those cranks and making sure.
Telling you the best zombie news and the things you need to know for keeping radiation at bay. Yes, I would love to keep podcasting with you guys no matter what. And hey, I mean, I'm just a freelancer at this point anyway, so it's not even that much of a stretch for me.
Right. We'll all be freelancers one day. Cool. So let's get into some video games. Maddie, why don't you start us off? What are you playing?
So I beat Outer Wilds, a cool video game you may have heard of, but we are going to spoil that later
in the
show.
Do you want to just give some broad, general, like spoiler-free thoughts before, and then a little bit later in the episode we'll get into spoilers?
Sure. I guess I'll just encourage anybody else who, like me, is frustrated by the controls of that game to just stick with it. I was glad I beat it. I thought the ending was emotionally satisfying and beautiful and worth getting to. There were certainly moments in the course of getting to that ending that I was frustrated with the game. There's a lot of times in that game when you have to revisit the same areas loop after loop after loop because they're filling with sand or ice has to melt or you just have to wait for something to happen or maybe you die in a stupid way and you just have to keep going back so you can read something there and it's like maybe one screen of reading and you're like, really? I did all this to get that one piece of information. The game is kind of like that. It can be frustrating, but I guess this is my inspirational plea to anyone else out there who's frustrated by it. I think it's worth it. I think the story is cool and I'm glad that I played it. So that's me. I don't know what nice. Else I could say without spoiling it.
Yeah. We'll get into specifics.
Yeah, we'll
when
talk
we talk
about that later. Are you playing anything else?
I am. So I'm playing Gears of War 4 because I still want to play Gears 5 when it comes out, and I believe I'm going to be reviewing it for Kotaku as well. So have you guys ever played Gears of War, any of them?
I've played all of them. I've played Gears of War 4 even. I played like 2/3.
Did
of
you play Judgment, the oft maligned secret Gears of War game? I didn't really like it that much either. So I don't know. I just really love these games. I played the first one in 2006, I believe is when it came out. And that was the game that I got really excited about my Xbox 360 for. I liked Halo, but I remember being like, this cover system is so cool. And I was so into it. And it's still so satisfying to me. And it's just funny to look back on it now and be like, wow, like this game's cover system blew me away so much in 2006. And it's still the same. And it still feels so satisfying to me to like press A to stick to something and like flip over something. I don't think the story in Gears of War 4 is very interesting to me personally.
Can you kind of recap it for me? I'm trying to remember what it's about. Is it like about Marcus's son?
It is about Marcus's son. So very broadly, the first three Gears of War games are about a group of humans who live on a planet that's not Earth, but is kind of like Earth. And at the beginning of the story, they realize that there are a bunch of locusts, monsters who live underneath the ground in the core of the planet. And they pop out and start attacking the humans who've colonized the planet. And so over the course of those three games, sort of an interesting story emerges. It starts out very basic and machismo focused in the first game, but by Gears of War 3, I would argue it gets a little more emotionally complicated, where you, as the player, are actually questioning whether the heroes really deserve to live on this planet or not, and what the locusts' motivations are. They're, you know, these mindless monsters seemingly, but they were there first. You're invading their land, etc. But in the end, you still defeat them all. Gears of War Judgment is like a weird in-between game that's about a court case. I wasn't a huge fan of it. I thought the writing was a little shaky. That was also after Cliff Bleszinski left the team and wasn't working on the games anymore.
It was a different group. It was People Can Fly that made Gears of War Judgment.
Right, right. And so even though the game plays in a similar way, like the guns still feel, the chainsaw still feels as satisfying to slice through a guy.
When you say it was about a court case, can you elaborate on that a little bit? Like they're in...
It was a neat idea, right? I thought narratively a cool idea.
It was a really cool idea, actually, and I wish I had enjoyed it more. So it's about a couple characters who are like on trial for, I don't know if it's like as far as a war crime, but like some sort like of
insubordination
mistake. Yeah, that they've made on the battlefield.
It's all like flashbacks.
Yes.
Like
so like
that.
You're in the courtroom and you like hear about something you did, and then a character will be like, that's not how it really happened. And then you go back and you play the mission and you sort of learn more, which is a really cool concept.
Very cool.
But in practice, it just didn't quite hang together. Like, there weren't really any twists to the story that I found particularly interesting. And the characters that they chose to focus on were not my faves. They were just the kind of side characters. So it was kind of a weird game. And so then in Gears of War 4, I feel like they have run into this problem where since they've gotten rid of the locusts, they don't really have a compelling narrative arc yet. I'm not far enough in the game yet to know where they're going to go. But they start out with this idea that now the government has sort of taken over the planet and these sort of disgraced former soldiers are on the run from the government and like stealing supplies. And there's these sort of lockdown areas of certain cities for some reason. I don't know because I haven't beaten the game yet, but there are these sort of like runaway soldiers that are former cogs and you're playing as them, and one of them is Marcus's son. You don't know what their situation is yet, or at least I don't. And then there's also, you're fighting robots basically, like government robots, because now the government is the enemy. And you could argue that was always the case in the previous Gears games, but it's like this very different thing from the locust threat. But I don't know how that's going to end, because I know that in Gears 5, in the trailers, they're doing some kind of locusty stuff again. So I'm like waiting for it to get back to the locust somehow. Like, they're still alive. I don't know. They're going to come back in some way. I always thought the Locust Queen was really cool. And
I think so. I think I know, just based on watching Steven.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Steven,
and Steven and I have talked about it a little bit, and he like gave me a mild spoiler that motivated me to play the game and be like, okay, I think I'm gonna like where this is going.
So,
I won't
yeah,
say what
I
it
think
is.
You'll think the ending is cool, and
I think so too.
Be really excited for 5.
Yeah, I'm already really excited for 5 anyway, because even though I don't super care about fighting robots in this particular game, I'm enjoying fighting so much because I just really like the feel of the guns in this game, and it is such a power fantasy, and I'm remembering that I just really like that kind of game where you just feel incredibly powerful the entire time. And I don't know, I know that's like kind of a shameful thing to admit now, like we're all supposed to be like, yeah, games, you know, really make us think and teach us something new about ourselves and teach us about a person's experience we've never had before. And I'm like, well, but maybe I just want to be like an extremely huge muscular guy who's getting a bunch of headshots and like destroying a bunch of robots, and I just feel so freaking good about myself every time I play this game in like a dirty way where I'm like, oh, this feels so good. And I mean, I enjoyed Outer Wilds a lot, but it was kind of like a weird readjustment of the way that I feel to go from beating Outer Wilds and then installing this game and just being like, oh my god, like this is so different. Like Outer Wilds, you're walking around, you're getting lost, you can barely, or at least if you're me, you can barely freaking do anything controls wise and I'm just constantly like fighting with the game trying to do the thing I want to do. And in Gears of War, I'm just immediately like settling into the armchair of understanding exactly how this game works and being like, ah, yes, this is the power. It's just an IV directly into my veins. It's delightful. Nice. Anyway, that's me. That's what I'm doing.
I don't actually know how Gears 4 ends because I didn't get to the ending, though I did get farther than it sounds like you are. And I'll just say that, yes, there are things that happen.
Great.
And it is a Gears of War game. So,
good.
You know, take that for what it is. Man, this reminds me, the thing about gun feel in Gears of War, I always think about Active Reload, which I think is what
yes,
a lot of people call
so
out,
fun.
Which is this, like the way they built this thing in where there's this little slider on your reload that then if you jam the button at the exact right time when the slider is like over the highlighted part, you like slam in extra bullets that do extra damage. It creates this like, the difference between Outer Wilds and Gears of War is like it creates a tactile versus a cerebral pleasure. And they're completely, the one is so tactile and the one is so cerebral.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there are tactile elements to Outer Wilds and there are cerebral elements to Gears of War. But that is funny. I also think about, speaking of Tim Rogers, I remember, I think I was talking to Tim about Destiny guns, because Destiny is another game people always talk about that feels good.
Yeah.
And one thing, there's a similar kind of a gun in both games. We were talking about the torque bow in Gears of War, which is the bow that, like, when you pull the trigger, this line kind of casts out from it, and then it straightens, and then the line gets heavier, and then, like, boom, if you fire it at the exact right time, it'll just, like, totally, like, punch through a guy from across the room. And it's like a delayed fire. And I think I was having this conversation with Tim about the fusion rifle in Destiny, which is also a gun where you pull the trigger and it charges up for a second, and there's this like feeling of like bam, and then it like fires, and there's the timing on it is such a key thing. Tim is really brilliant at talking about like game feel and game mechanics. He's like a savant at it, and so he was, I don't even remember the language he was using, but it was really cool. And just that conversation, it was the first time I'd thought about that. I was like, yeah, totally, like a delayed thing like that. So I feel like the people who make Gears of War games are so good.
They are
coming up with those kinds of ideas.
The grenades have a similar feel too, because they're like a little lasso that you're like twirling around before you throw it, and it has that kind of delayed gratification before you see the arc of it flying. And then even the chainsaw, the Lancer, like has the slight delay where you're like, all right, I'm gonna rev it up, and then you get to feel the controller vibrate as you're like slicing a guy. I don't know, it's, there's just something about that like slight delay in time between you hitting the button and your controller almost like revving up to prepare you for whatever explosion or thing is about to happen that feels awesome.
God, the grenades. It's like, why would they throw grenades like World War One style,
know.
Like a lasso, other than that
it, chainsaw?
Because it feels
like
cool.
It's
like
so
that's why.
Silly.
Yeah,
it's
because
so
it feels cool to do it.
I'm surprised more games haven't copied that active reload idea, because it's such a
they
fun
have.
Way.
Some have. Yeah. Oh,
okay. I remember I in like a few years after Gears of War the first, or I can't remember if it was the second one where the active reload was added. Don't people can write in and correct me, but I do
it
remember
was
the
first
there was a phase where a lot of games had a similar style where if you hit a button at the right time, same deal with cover shooters. Like I feel like there are a few other kind of copycat games.
Well, so
that
actually
time.
Something that was interesting is I believe that Epic wound up taking the Gears cover system and putting it out. I don't know if it was free or if you had to buy it, but like if you were a game studio that used the Unreal Engine, you could actually use the Gears of War cover system. And that was like part of their whole hook for getting everyone on their engine, was like giving out some of the code and animations and systems that they had already created for Gears. It sounds like Gears 5 will be an interesting topic of discussion in the near future.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to playing
I think
it.
That might be my first Gears game as well, if I have time, although September is
you can
a little
DM
ridiculous.
Me when you have lore questions.
Yeah,
I'll let you know.
I totally will. So what's a locust? Kirk, what about you? What are you playing?
All right. I played a couple of things. I finished Fire Emblem's Golden Deer Story Path. So
okay.
Congrats.
I powered through that. Yeah, thanks.
It.
It's long. That's a long game. JRPGs are always so long. There's always the point at which you think it ends, and then you're like, nope, it's not going to end because this is a JRPG, and we're going to do at least two more chapters.
God.
I really liked it a lot. I liked the story a lot. I really came to like the Golden Deer. I think Claude is rad. His politics are great, and like he makes a, it kind of winds up being a lot of these interesting little micro arguments about how this kingdom might work, even though it is still like a kind of a kingdom where people rule by power and stuff. There's a lot of interesting political stuff going on if you care and want to read all the dialogue. So that was neat. The music is killer. There's actually some really funny musical stuff that happens toward the end that I won't spoil.
Man, I'm so upset that when you get funny. To the second half, the battle theme changes and you don't get the first half battle theme anymore.
I am fine with that because I really like the new battle theme, because there's a part where like this choir comes in and then a penny whistle comes in behind them. I don't know why or how the penny whistle became.
Penny whistle.
You can't. Like every JRPG, there's a part where the penny whistle comes in, and it's like the most epic shit, and that happens in this game. And in the second half, so okay, we're here's what we're doing on spoilers for talking about Fire Emblem right now. We're not going to say any specific stuff, but I think it is very widely understood that there is a time jump in the middle of this game, and also that at some point, like, you wind up fighting against the other houses. So I think we're going to We're going to just say those two things and not anything specific. But after the time jump, when you get back together with your students, you know, everyone's older, and it's this very amazing, amazing dramatic moment, and the new music is playing, and that choir is in, and then the penny whistle came, and I was like, oh, shit, the penny whistle is in. Here we go.
Oh, shit, penny like, whistle. Shit's gotten real. Oh, we got the penny whistle.
So I do like the second battle theme a lot, too, and the musical stuff.
You should
happens.
Add
like
a penny whistle to the split screen theme song, Kirk.
Mm.
I've thought about it. I have two penny whistles. I bought two and learned how to play them, and I'm going to use them for something or other. Maybe I'll do a penny whistle version of the split screen theme at some
after
point.
The time jump. Oh, that'd be where fun. We yeah. change it utterly.
Would sound, yeah. That would actually sound kind of good. Okay, maybe I'll do that in the future at some point. Anyways, I liked it a lot. It is gets a lot harder, I found, toward the end. I was challenged somewhat by the last few missions. Like, it was never super hard, especially because there are missions where you're just getting swamped by enemies, and I found that the challenge was just like I would bring fewer people into the battle because my healers and stuff would just be getting killed, and I didn't want to deal with it. So one time I reloaded a fight and just left Mercedes, my healer, on the sidelines, and then basically would just like mainline my main character for the boss and just be like, okay, we're gonna get the lieutenant.
And that's what makes it okay. So I have different thoughts, and one of them is that it's kind of I've grown to, I don't want to say dislike, but it's certainly, I've gotten cooler on it after the time skip and like in the second half. And one of the main reasons for that is that it's still just so easy, and not even easy in a way where like raising the difficulty would help, because it's just totally unbalanced. Like once you have a couple of powerhouse characters, they can just run through and do everything and nobody will actually do any damage to them. And then your weaker characters will get hit in one kill, one or killed in one hit by a flying enemy, so you have to keep them away, and it's just not fun. There's no strategy involved. It's just like beeline for the boss, and what you just described is also that's not like a fun strategy gameplay. And so
I mean I had fun, so like I found it
no I should and say I, okay it I wasn't should say fun. That's not a you're not making interesting decisions. You're not like doing the types of things that you would want from like a proper strategy game.
It is not on the level of like XCOM 2 is a game that comes to mind as something where you're really obsessing over every move because you
or
need
Final
every
Fantasy Tactics.
And there would be times in the harder battles where it would be a really dicey shot on one of my characters and they'd almost die, and I'd have that feeling of, you know, really intense, like, oh shit. And then, you know, your character dodges it and counterattacks them and like lands the killing blow, and you're so psyched because it totally went your way when it might not have. And that drama is missing from the game. So the fun that I'm finding is elsewhere. And I did start a new game plus on hard, and so we'll see how that goes. But yeah, I'm with you. And they're going to release, I think, a third difficulty that will, I would imagine, be harder. But you're right that it's a little weird. I don't know what the solution is in a game where you can power level people. Like, you can just go grind.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
infinite.
Well, I found that you accidentally power level people, because if you wind up, if you have, especially with your main character, if he's like in front and suddenly on the enemy's turn, they like barrel at him with five different enemies and he just counters them all and kills them all. It's like suddenly he's two levels above everybody else, and that just keeps happening over and over again. There's no way to prevent it.
Yeah. I don't know how you would solve for that exactly, like designing a game, even though like it's just this type of game. I guess I haven't played Final Fantasy Tactics in a while, and I don't know how
that
works, but it's just a different
game.
Kind of
that's
a,
like the yeah, quintessential, like this is what a strategy game could be, because there are ways to make yourself overpowered in Final Fantasy Tactics, but like there's always some level of like, well, first of all, you have the choice, so you can kind of restrict yourself and be like, okay, I'm not going to use this super overpowered character Orlando who shows up later in the game and just demolishes everything. But there's also such a level of depth that isn't in Fire Emblem because of the amount of customization you can do to each character. And I think fewer characters but deeper characters is just such a better way to go. But then you lose Fire Emblem's personalities and like getting to know everybody and having conversations with them.
I think that Fire Emblem's general flow is really fun. Like, I think it works great. And there is a lot of depth there that actually just feels like it's not being used. There are all these weapons that do special damage against mounted units and armor units, and there's all these different types of elemental damage. Right, and that's maybe a function of the normal difficulty, and I think on a harder, you'd maybe be thinking about it more. There's a lot of min-maxing I didn't focus about. Anyways, so yeah, we've talked a lot about Fire Emblem. It's really good. I started a new game plus and actually did Blue Lions. The one thing I was surprised by after finishing was that I found myself with more unanswered questions about Blue Lions than Black Eagles. Those are the two houses that I didn't do.
Interesting.
And so I was like, I'm going to do Blue Lions, actually. I kind of want to know more, and I I came to realize that I think maybe those characters are more interesting than I thought they were when I started. And so that's what I'm doing. And I'm playing on hard. And I played enough just to see how it works. It's a cool new game plus system. I won't go into the details, but it like lets you skip through, like fast forward through some of the stuff you've already done, like the progression stuff, which is nice, but you get to choose how you do it. And I just wanted to see how it works. But now I'm taking a break. I mean, I played like 60 hours or something. And definitely toward the end, I was kind of just flying through months and doing seminars and skipping through things, just being like, okay, it's time to finish this game.
Yeah,
like,
that's what I mean.
Like any JRPG.
Yeah, well, that's part of what I mean. I've found so far, I'm like pretty thick into the second half, although I'm on the alternate route, and I won't get into specifics, but those of you who have played the game probably know what I'm talking about. I'm on I accidentally wound up on the fourth alternate route instead of one of the three other ones. But anyway, so I also am finding myself just like skipping mainlining things. I used to put so much effort into the goals and making sure every character was optimally learning things, and then at a certain point I was like, none of this matters, because the only way to successfully beat these battles is just to use my overpowered characters anyway and like keep my healers away from the flyers. So yeah, I find that a little bit disappointing. It feels like you make a good point that there's like this depth that isn't properly being used, and I think it's just like a lack of like the balance is just all totally out of whack. Yeah, and the other thing about the various systems is that I feel like there's too much micromanagement. I texted you the other day saying, like, I wish there was a way you could have each character have a goal class, and then so then you could see that class and what skills they require when you're actually figuring out the goals. Because right now you have to do a lot of just like keeping information straight in your head and going through and just like memorizing exactly what you want each character to be studying. And it's all just kind of like a big clunky mess in general. So yeah, there are things that I wish this game had done differently, but it's super charming and the characters are all fantastic. And I have learned to love so many of them. And I will probably wind up playing it again and just like skipping ahead and playing the battles on autopilot or something like that, because I also want to see some of the other paths and like what they look like. So TBD. What else?
Yeah, particularly given what I know of your path, you should definitely play one of the main path storylines.
Yeah,
there's just a lot. There's like four full chapters that you're not even seeing.
So, yeah, we have to compare notes at some point, because it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Like everybody I've seen talk about it or have talked to you about the game storyline is like, okay, you're on the bad path or like the evil path. And from my perspective, it's like, this totally makes sense. Like, I'm being sold. I'm being brainwashed into like thinking right. This is the righteous path.
Amazing.
So I'm very curious to see the other routes, because the game is doing a good job of selling me on this path.
Yeah,
I'm
I feel
on.
The same way about the path you're on, though. I know that there is a justification for it. It's like I said, there are these interesting little political disagreements where each group kind of has their own perspective, and they all make sense, you know, and I'm sure that one you're on does too. So yeah, we'll have to compare notes. And
yeah,
because there's a lot of stuff
the
that
political
I learned,
stuff. It's also like they've convinced me that a character is evil that you told me is totally not evil, and I'm like, wait a minute, what? So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I'll be curious to hear how you've been brainwashed. So the other thing that I played was some No Man's Sky after the Beyond update. I finally played some No Man's Sky VR. And it was, it's pretty amazing once it works, which is, I guess, like the VR, that could be the tagline. VR, it's pretty amazing once it works. I'm playing on PC with an original Oculus Rift, not a Rift S, and the touch controls. And it was a pain in the ass to get it working. It's not optimized very well for VR, though it's better. They've been patching it. I actually didn't have too much trouble once I got all the VR stuff working with optimization. Like, it runs okay. It's a little bit weird. Like, the frame rate gets a little weird, but generally it runs pretty well. It's more that, you know, VR itself is just a little bit of a different kind of an experience for a game like this. But man, first of all, the Beyond update is crazy. Like, they've added so much stuff. They've made it so that a lot of the stuff you're doing is very clearly signposted. Like, you should do this and you need to do this. So if you're trying to build like a thing for your base, you can then go into your menu now and it'll just show you all the steps you're going to have to do, all the items you're going to have to collect, how to make those items. There's a lot of little stuff that's like just makes the game more clear and easy to tell what you're supposed to do, which is cool because in the next update, they added all this other stuff like bounties and all these new things for you to go do. And then I think they added the story. I don't know if that was the next. They've added all this stuff over the years.
Yeah.
And now this kind of ties it all together and adds like a multiplayer hub that I haven't even seen yet. There's so much shit in this game. It's crazy.
It's such an interesting phenomenon, by the way, in video games that so many games wind up having more development time after the release than actually before the release. But yeah, go on.
This really does. I mean, Subnautica and No Man's Sky are so similar in so many ways. If No Man's Sky, it just goes back to a thing we said a million times, that if No Man's Sky had been released as an early access game and had spent 3 years in early access, like next really kind of feels like the final release, but this does too. Like it all, you know, I kind of want to start a new game, except that I did all this grinding for like all these sweet items with my one saves. I'm like, when I started up, I'm like, I can't do this again and get all these S-class things that I saved up for this 1 week where I just put on podcasts and like did a lot of grinding in the game. So I'm sticking with that save. Anyways, that's all cool. The VR thing, though, is incredible when it works. So I think that it's that I know the game. Like, I've played a ton of No Man's Sky, so I know No Man's Sky, and I've, like, been in that game, so then the experience of being in that game in VR is really amazing, because it isn't like playing a VR game that I've only ever played in VR. It's this game that I'm very familiar with, but then suddenly I'm standing there next to my ship, or, like, next to a big alien plant that's this weird bulbous thing, and everything feels huge when you're in VR. Like, you realize how small your character is actually in the game and how big everything around you is, and it really feels like you're standing there, you know, in that way that VR feels, and it's really cool. Like the just overall feeling of the game is really, really neat. And then also I'm very, very impressed with how much work Hello Games put into the VR version. It's totally not half-baked. Like, it's not optimized perfectly. It needs a little work. Going by their track record, they'll probably get it there. It seems like they're, you know, they just keep working and working on this game. But they've like redone the whole UI now. Like, to get to your inventory, for example, you have like hands, right? If you're using touch controls, you'll pick up your hand and then you point, and like a floating screen comes up above your hand and you point at it, and your inventory comes up as this like big floating thing in front of you that's like a floating screen. Then you use your right hand to point at what you want, and you pick it up with the trigger and move it around. Like, it's all completely designed, like redesigned from the ground up. Like, the whole UX and everything is like designed to be accessible within VR, which is super cool. Or like, you get into a ship, and to fly the ship, it's a little weird. You use touch controls. So you pick up the stick and the throttle with your motion controllers, and then you move them like with your hands. Like, it's like motion control flying instead of using the thumbsticks to do it. But it works, actually. It works fine. And then, you know, you land, and like, to get out, you'll reach over and pick up, like, you like lift the cockpit with your hand, and then you get out. So they've built, this is all new stuff. Like, that's just, that stuff doesn't even exist in the main game on the screen. So they've built like a whole VR game, basically, that's their game, but in VR.
So, and wait, when you say sweet. You're flying the ship with your hands, do you mean there's like a throttle that you're actually holding with your own hand, like within the game?
Or no.
What
yes.
do you mean?
So like, there's a virtual throttle and
right.
a virtual stick
okay.
in the game. Like, and then you're just holding these like, you know, controllers in your hand that have
right.
like triggers on them. And when you're sitting down, you move your hands over those things,
mm-hmm.
and then you press the grip buttons on your controllers, and your virtual hands will take the stick and the throttle. And then you like move your hand forward or backward, and the throttle will move up and down. And you move your stick hand around, like, you know, like you're kind of moving the hand around, and then the stick in the game will move, but you're not actually holding a stick and a throttle. You're just holding like the motion
controllers. That sounds
yeah.
cool, though.
it works surprisingly well. Like, considering that motion control is always a little bit weird, it's kind of fine. And it really, like, the feeling of walking up to your ship, getting in it, and like lifting off and flying into space, like, it really feels like you're doing that, and is pretty sweet. So yeah, I'm impressed just that they did it and they made it as good as it already is. And I, you know, I hope they make it better, but I'm guessing they probably will. And yeah, it's a pretty cool experience.
Kirk, I don't think I'll ever enjoy VR, but I'll always enjoy your enthusiasm about VR.
Yeah, I'm like, great. I would throw up immediately if I tried to fly the ship in that way, but it sounds great.
We're still so far out on it, but the minute when you're actually doing it and you're standing there, it's like, well, yeah, this is like the future of friggin' entertainment. Like, I always have that feeling when I'm actually there. I'm like, this is like, if I could have shown this to myself when I was 13 or something, mm-hmm. I would have probably died and then not exist now, because my 13-year-old self would have like had a brain aneurysm.
Yeah,
how
like
awesome
holding motion controllers to like take off in a ship into like a series of alien worlds that are procedurally. Yeah. It's like, that is the dream, right?
Like, and you're like standing in it, like mm-hmm. you're literally looking around and there's like a giant alien creature walking past you. Like, it is very cool to just look at it that way.
Very cool. All right. So as for me, I've been playing Fire Emblem. We talked about that. That's pretty much it. I have a bunch of Switch games en route in the coming weeks that I will be playing. So be prepared for Switch-tember.
Nice.
And then I've also been, this isn't really a game, but I've been using this web browser app called Wani Kani, which is a way to learn the kanji in Japanese. And it's really, really good and really addictive. So if anyone out there is like learning Japanese, I highly recommend it. You have to pay for it. It's pretty expensive, I think, but I haven't paid for it yet because the first couple of levels are free. And basically it's this way of like testing out your kanji. You guys know what kanji are, right? They're the picture characters in Japanese.
I've played Persona 5. I know.
You have. So there are thousands of them that you need to learn if you want to be able to read Japanese. I think it's like 2,000 are the most commonly used ones. And so that's quite an intimidating feat. But the way that this app works is that it starts off with, it gives you a few at a time. It gives you radicals. It gives you kanji. It gives you vocab words. And it does this technique called spaced out repetition, where basically it's on a timer. And like every couple hours, it'll be like, here are some new reviews, and it'll quiz you, and you have to enter each one, and it gives you all these mnemonics that help you think about like both the meaning and the pronunciation of each one, which are really, really helpful. The they're really good. They give you like these associated stories that help you remember them, and they're actually really, really useful. And then by spacing it out, it helps you remember it even better, because it's like you can't just do them all at once and then move on to the next level. You have to actually wait. And so it might take you a couple of days before you've really mastered each kanji, and you can't unlock new ones until you've unlocked each previous level. So partially, that's a really good way for them to make a bunch of money, because they charge you, I think, monthly, yearly, whatever it is, by subscription. So spacing out the repetition like allows them to keep charging you. But also, it's a really good way to learn. And I'm already feeling myself just like already my vocab has gotten so much better as a result of using this for like the past week or two. Nice. So if you're out there and you want to learn Japanese, I highly recommend Wani Kani. All right, why don't we take a break, and then we will get into some news, followed by an Outer Wilds spoiler cast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts, and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Hey And we are back. Let's get into some video game news of the week. None of this is like particularly interesting, like groundbreaking, like bombshell. We have to talk about this for an entire episode.
Groundbreaking bombshells. The violence of video game news.
But on Monday, there was a bunch of streams. I had to spend my entire day watching streams, so I thought I would share some with you.
You all have to experience this now, too.
Yeah, because cool. Gamescom is happening in Germany. I'm sure a lot of our European listeners have gone out there because it's actually the biggest video game convention in the world. I think they get hundreds of thousands of people out there. So they did some new stuff. It's not quite E3 on the level of news, but they had a couple of interesting things. The day started off on Monday with a Nintendo Indies Direct. Nothing super crazy there. Switch ports of games like Super Hot and Hotline Miami, which are pretty cool. Ori and the Blind Forest is the big exciting one that was announced there. I'm sure that I will play the hell out of that, because it is a Metroidvania, and I'm in the market for a new Metroidvania on my Switch.
It's really
for
good.
Sure.
That's a really good game.
Have you played it all?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess I didn't finish it. I played a lot of it, though. It's great.
Yeah, I didn't finish it either.
How's it compared to Hollow Knight?
I remember enjoying it, though. It's not Hollow Knight.
It's not Hollow Knight, but I mean, what is? But like, it's still really cool. It's really well designed, and it's friggin' gorgeous. I mean, it's like so gorgeous. And also, it'll make you cry in the first 10 minutes.
Oh,
like,
man.
It's
super
emotional. Like, the opening is so brutally emotionally manipulative, but also wonderful. It has beautiful music. It's great, man.
Sometimes you gotta manipulate people's emotions. That's fine.
Yeah.
Well, I will play the hell out of that. And then after that, there was an Inside Xbox stream. And I don't know if you guys have ever watched these Inside Xbox presentations.
Oh, you know I have.
You have.
I never watched one.
Okay, so like...
Lovely.
I will preface this by saying there are a lot of talented people up there. A lot of the hosts are very charismatic and talented, and they're good at what they do. But like, Microsoft really needs to reevaluate what they're doing. They're basically trying to do what Nintendo does, which is like a regular stream for fans to get updates on the news. But instead of making it this short, snappy, like news-packed presentation, they turn it into this two-hour, like boring snooze fest of a show where it's just like so much of it is just inane babble and just like boring stuff, whether it's non-news or like interviews with developers who are just being asked how awesome their games are and responding, "Our game is really awesome." It is just excruciating. I'm in a position where I have to watch it because it was my job to watch it and monitor for news and stuff. And I imagine if you're a hardcore Xbox fan, maybe it's a little bit different. Maybe you care more. But still, they have a long way to go if they really want to compete with Nintendo on this stuff. And just like, everyone needs to do what Nintendo does and like put together a presentation like that. But then again, that leads to the next thing, which is that Stadia had what they call a Stadia Connect. And they've actually gotten good, or started out good at emulating Nintendo's format in that it's game after game after game, and it's nice and snappy. The problem is that they didn't have any games to announce. Stadia's presentation was just like, here are a bunch of games that you've already seen and heard of and know about, and here's the same old footage you've seen and heard before, except now they're coming to Stadia, which doesn't mean anything to anybody.
And that may change in fairness. Like, that doesn't mean anything to anybody because Stadia is not out. So it's weird.
Right.
Like, when a Nintendo announces The Witcher 3 is coming to Switch, people get excited because people own Switches, and therefore that means something to them. When Google is like, Cyberpunk is coming to Stadia, you think, okay, no one has a Stadia. I don't know if that's cool, or maybe the Stadia sucks. Like, we still have no idea. So it's a little odd at this point in time.
I should say, before we get into this, I should say that there was one new game announcement, which is Orcs Must Die 3, which is cool. I mean, tower defense game, pretty cool stuff. Fun fact, made by the Robot Entertainment, which came out of the wreckage of Ensemble Entertainment, which was the Age of Empire folks back in the day. Not only do we not know what Stadia is or have a Stadia or like know how it performs.
Well, we know what it nominally is.
We know what it is, but we don't know how effective it is. But also, right. like, Switch, when something is coming to Switch, the implied value there to the user is, oh, I can take this on the go and play mm-hmm. it anywhere. Stadia does not have that. You can't play Stadia games.
I am not even trying to begin a comparison between the Switch and the Stadia. Like, that's not even worth doing. I'm just saying, like, there's a reason that one means something to people and one doesn't. And
totally.
A large part of that is because they have the system in question.
Yeah, no, 100%. And the other part of this is that I just keep thinking, like, Stadia, like, what is it offering to people? I just don't think there's as big an audience out there who is willing to, who doesn't want a console, doesn't want to pay for a console, but is willing to pay $60 for Cyberpunk when it comes out on Stadia. I just don't, like, maybe there'll be a small chunk of people who are like, you know what, I want to play games at 60 frames a second and Stadia can do that for me because I have a good internet but can't afford a console or can't afford a PC or whatever else. But, like, I think the audience they're trying to reach, which is the millions and millions of people who are not, like, super hardcore gamers, who do not own Xboxes or PlayStations, but might be interested, they are conditioned to not pay for games. Like, they don't want to pay $60 for a game. They're used to their iPhones being able to download whatever they want or, like, playing a couple of bucks max. So I just don't see a market out there for people who are gonna buy Cyberpunk for $60 but only on Stadia. I just don't get it.
Don't you think that, like, the crazy, so crazy it might work strategy for Google would be to be the ultimate loss leader and, like, tell everyone, okay, buy a Stadia dongle for $30, and for the first year, you just get every game for free, and they just eat the cost of that because they're Google. They have whatever, like $1 trillion, I guess. I don't know.
Well,
and
so how,
this is ridiculous. I'm not offering business advice, and I don't think this would work. I mean, like, they pay for the games. Like, they pay whatever.
Like, they pay the developers back whatever fee they would need to pay.
So, but wait. So, if I'm CD Projekt Red and I'm like, okay, so you're going to pay me $60 for every copy of Cyberpunk that's downloaded?
Yeah.
But that would be hundreds of millions of copies potentially downloaded that they would have to pay.
All right, don't poke holes in my ridiculous idea. It would never work. Basically, okay, or maybe some version of that. I don't know. But, right, like, it's the only way, and this is, and I guess that maybe proves the point that this is not actually a workable strategy.
It's
the only way I could see it working would be if you could do that and then everyone would get one and you would get all these games for free. Like, so many, I would do that. I mean, for $30, you could give it a shot. And then if they're very confident in their technology and it blows everybody away that it really works, that's how you kind of get one in every house. And then when you start charging people for them, they think, oh, okay, yeah, Stadia is a viable option to play games on. But short of that, which, as you pointed out, and for plenty of other reasons too, is an actually ridiculous suggestion that could never work. Well, I don't know either. I mean, I guess we'll see.
Yeah, but I mean, the only actual feasible method would be the Netflix-like approach that Microsoft is already doing with Xbox Game Pass, because that would be an incredible value. If you get a Stadia and you're paying $10 a month and you get maybe not the highest-end, newest games like Cyberpunk, but maybe you get a collection of, like, year-old games and you don't have to buy an Xbox or a PC to play them because they're all streaming. And if Google came out with a monthly subscription service that was as robust or even better than Microsoft's, then we would have something. Then they'd be cooking.
And,
I think that would
crucially,
be interesting.
You would keep the games no matter what. Like, it wouldn't be like Netflix where there's a rotating catalog and things go away. Because
right, you'd have to be able to download them.
You can't lose
them.
The game that you're halfway through.
Well, no, you don't. Well, you can't download them, first of all. I mean, you can't download anything
right.
on Stadia.
No, but I mean, but you still have your progress. Like, I think that would be a major problem if they follow the exact Netflix model.
Yeah, that would be tricky. I mean, I think if they gave you enough warning, maybe if a screen popped up when you started playing and it was like, this will be going away in a month. But yeah, I don't know.
Oh, that'd be so
that's
annoying.
That's a tough one. That's, yeah, that's a really tough
should
one.
Do that for TV shows, right? You're starting season one of an 8-season show, just so you know, at the end of the month,
do.
That's going
on
away.
On Netflix, they do, actually. They have a...
Oh, yeah, you're right, they do. They
it
did
says,
start doing
like,
that,
this will be going away on January, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but... Regardless, I mean, practical, like, the logistical details aside, and there are definitely some that would need to be sorted out. Like, when I first heard that Stadia, actually, I was actually, like, super excited for Stadia when I first heard rumors about it. I think it was GDC of 2018, because everyone was really excited. Google is entering the ring. They're throwing their weight behind this big Netflix-like streaming platform. There were rumors of some sort of hardware, which turned out to be the controller that they're playing around with. But then I started hearing that you would have to buy games individually. And I was just like, this is dead in the water. It's just so much lost potential here.
Didn't the Stadia stream like have streaming problems on YouTube? Like on Google owned YouTube? I mean, that strikes me as pretty funny.
Yeah. Like, although I will say, I mean, in all fairness, I did the Project Stream test last year when they made it available with Assassin's Creed Odyssey, and it worked pretty well. It wasn't 60 frames a second, it was like 30, and there was like enough input lag that you could notice it when you press a button. It was like that tiny little half second of input lag that like is enough to bother you if you played the game before. But it worked. I mean, it didn't stutter at all for me when I was playing it. So yeah, that's the Stadia stuff. Again, just feels dead in the water to me, and it's too bad because they had so much potential. And then there was Jeff Keighley put on like a version of the VGA show for Gamescom, and this one was pretty dull. The most interesting thing actually happened via press release in the middle of it, which was that Sony sent out this PR that they had bought Insomniac, which is not a shocking move, but still a pretty monumental one. The interesting thing about that isn't that Sony owns Insomniac, because Insomniac was basically making PS4 only game or PlayStation games for years and years, other than a couple of exceptions, other than VR games with Oculus, and other than
that's an important
Rise
exception.
And
that's an important exception. They made some of the best VR games for Oculus that they will now presumably not be making, and will probably be making PSVR games.
Yeah, well, so they're still making Stormland, which is the one they'd already announced, and then
yeah, I'm psyched for that.
After that, I'm sure their VR team will move to PSVR. But if you look at Insomniac's history, it's like Resistance, Ratchet and Clank, Spyro. It's all PlayStation games mostly. Other than Sunset Overdrive and Fuse, which were Microsoft and EA, respectively. But anyway, the really what I was getting at is the interesting part of this is that this is the biggest independent game studio in North America, and now it's not independent anymore. And between that and like Double Fine and Obsidian both getting snatched up by Microsoft, it just feels like it's you can't live as an indie game studio anymore. It's just not possible, which is sad. It's sad. It's like I'm happy for the stability of the employees there, and hopefully a bunch of them all get paid big time, but like it's sad to think that like, oh, another cool indie company is now part of a corporation.
It's been a great couple of weeks for faith in corporate ownership.
Definitely. Sure. So true. Yeah.
Yeah, other than that, there were a couple of announcements. Kerbal Space Program 2 got announced, a bunch of other random-ass trailers. There's a game called Disintegration, which is made by Marcus Leto, who is one of the co-creators of Halo, and he has a team of mostly, I think, ex-Bungie people, but other Seattle game devs, and they're working on this game called Disintegration that looks cool, looks like a Halo-ish, Destiny-ish type game. Hideo Kojima came up on stage, and the Keighley Kojima stuff is really out of control, just like their romantic relationship and the way that Keighley just like touts him all the time and glamorizes him. It's pretty ridiculous. And he showed off more Death Stranding, which just looks absurd, and so we'll see how that goes. There's apparently a P button. You can press a button to like pee.
To pee.
Yeah.
It's gonna be a great game.
Oh, Kirk, I don't know if you saw this, but Jeff Keighley is in the game. Jeff Keighley is motion captain.
One of our friends told us that, and I thought he was kidding.
Did you miss all the memes?
Right.
Of the Twitter memes?
I missed most of the memes, but I can imagine them. You know, the minute I heard it, the memes all happened in my brain, so I think I'm good.
Cool. Yeah, so that game will be ridiculous. And that's about it for Gamescom news. Nothing really mind-blowing. So let's get to it, shall we? So we are going to spoil Outer Wilds, the adventure game that came out a couple of months ago. So if you are not interested, if you have not played Outer Wilds, you do not want to be spoiled, now is your time to skip ahead or turn off the podcast. You can, if you look in the description of the pod, you'll find a timestamp for the off-topic news. So you can just skip ahead to that if you want. Kirk, do you want to put like a little musical buffer for Outer Wilds so we can warm people off of spoilers?
Yeah, I'll play some music right now. For the This is from the Outer Wild soundtrack, which is actually now streaming. It's like on streaming services.
Which is incredible.
This music was composed by Andrew Pralhau, which I think he's part of this team that made the game. The music in this game is so good.
So you can stream the whole thing now.
So good.
Cool. So, Maddie, why don't you start, since you finished it just this week? Why don't you give us some overall spoilery thoughts?
So I remember last week I was talking about how I don't know what order to go in, because even this game, I played it out of order. There's no correct order to play anything in.
There is no order.
I discovered many things at the wrong time. It is definitely hilarious.
No, there is a wrong time. That's part of the charm.
Exactly.
Things fit into your brain in a different way depending in what order you discover them,
which is cool. It is very funny to me in retrospect that I discovered I think it's the Tower of Quantum Knowledge. It's that place on Giant's Deep so early on. Like the first time I booted up the game, that was like one of the first places I went.
So funny.
And the reason I went there, Jason, was because there is actually a frequency that you can dial to. It was like a spooky flute or something that plays that you get there to. And so I'd gotten there, and I remember I couldn't get past all of the trials because I just didn't understand how to do it yet. So like the loop ended before I could beat all of the tower. And then I played many more hours of the game, obviously. And I kept
I get this game, because you thought it was a bunch of like towers, the trials.
I thought it was like a Myst game, which I would actually say this game is very similar to Myst in certain ways, where you're walking around the same area a lot and there's like an opaque puzzle that you just eventually figure out by moving things around, which that's something good and bad about Myst that I feel like Outer Wilds has a lot. But so then later I was like, I know that tower is on Giant's Deep, and I could not find it. Like, I kept flying around because it's inside of a tornado. It's inside of that huge tornado, and I just kept being like, that's fine. I just kept flying around, like, on Giant's Deep for just ages, being like, am I insane? Did that tower never exist?
Oh, man. So, this is too... You're gonna be kicking yourself now, but, like, you can actually set a waypoint to it by going into your ship's computer.
Yes, and looking at the map thing that you're creating, and you can like set a directional waypoint to go back and find stuff. I didn't realize you could do that until later on. There were a few things I didn't realize till later on. Like, for example, I wrote that post about how to get to the Black Hole Forge. And so I went back to the Black Hole Forge so that I could take a picture of it for that post. And in so doing, I was like, oh, I found all the different ways you can get there, just because I kind of knew that you could go down that. There's that glacier on that planet, I think it's Brittle Hollow with the black hole, and you can like slide down the glacier and then get there. And I don't know, there's some ways that the game actually tries to make your life easier in certain ways, but a lot of times I would do the hard way first and then not realize until later that there had actually been an easier way to do the puzzle the entire time, and I was just like going the long way or just doing something really dumb. Oh, and the other thing I wanted to say, I'll let you guys talk eventually, but this is a monologue about all the puzzles I solved and I'm not done yet. So
give it to us.
The other one is the Ash Twin teleporters, which you were surprised that I stood in the sand to get into the core of Ash Twin. And the reason I did that is because it was like relatively early on in my playthrough that I explored that. And I was just like, I don't understand how the teleporters work in this game. Sometimes you look down, sometimes you look up. I don't know how they work. And low key, I still don't fully know how they work. Whatever. You sort of have to be facing the direction that you're teleporting to. But I don't know why sometimes you have to look down, sometimes you have to look up. I guess just because that's what direction you're facing. And at that time when I was playing, I definitely didn't understand that the wheel needs to be turning, or whatever contraption at the top of the tower that you're in that has a teleporter needs to be turning. I just hadn't like put all that together yet. So I was just like, okay, well, this teleporter clearly isn't doing anything, but there is this huge column of sand going around the planet. So maybe that powers the teleporter in some way. I don't know. And I had also figured out that if you stand in the column of sand, you can get sucked up to Ember Twin by it. And I did that by accident a few times and was like, oh, so I can travel between the planets using this column of sand. Cool. Maybe the column of sand can teleport me somewhere. So I like thought it had teleported me somewhere, but I didn't know where. I just was like, all right, I'm in a new location. And then I like read everything in the location without realizing I was in the core of Ash Twin and just being like, oh, this is interesting information. I guess this is the Ash Twin project. I don't know where I physically am.
That's so funny.
It is really funny.
You like learned all the deepest secrets before you did anything else.
It was interesting because I think that it kind of grounded me in some of the lore of the game, which was good for me because I needed that, I guess, emotionally in order to continue. Like, the Ashwin Project lore, there's a lot of stuff to read down there. And I think that's where they... I can't remember if that's where you learn about the 22-minute time loop or the fact that memories are getting sent back to the statues. I don't know that you learn that.
Well, but you can learn about both of those things from different places, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, but I think that in the Ashwin Project, you do at least learn about like the sun station and the idea mm-hmm. of the sun going supernova and that being like a goal that the Nomai had. And that sort of grounded me in the game. And I was kind of like, okay, like I think I get what the grand puzzle is that I'm solving here. And that just helped me going forward because it just, the game, depending on what order you played in, the game takes a really long time to reveal that information to you. And for the first like half of me playing it, I definitely was like, I don't know what anything is and I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm just going to play this game and see. But yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I'm done. Monologue over.
I have a few thoughts on things you said. First of all, I did something similar to you. So the Temple of Quantum Knowledge or the Tower of Quantum Knowledge, mm-hmm. that's where you learn about how looking away from quantum objects causes yes. them to relocate, and you have mm-hmm. to climb those walls by like placing yep. the things in, looking
and
away,
like,
and then
looking
having them
at a crystal as you're climbing, and then keeping right, it in view right, and then at looking certain away. Times. Yeah.
So I found that really early on as well. I actually was like, there has to be something in this huge tornado that's at the top of the planet, and I figured out how to go in, and I went there, and I actually had a really similar experience to you where I thought, oh, okay, so each planet is going to have one of these towers and I'm going to have to solve some new puzzle that's going to teach me a new thing. And like that's at so first funny. I thought it was the same thing that Ghost Matter is kind of this fake out in the game where you learn about Ghost Matter, this thing that kills you, and you think, oh, okay, so at some point I'm going to get uh-huh. a device that lets me bypass this. But yep. you don't, because you never get any devices in the game. And I discovered that puzzle, that sequence of puzzles, before I understood that. So I thought, oh, maybe I don't have what I need to solve this. And then
like
actually
Metroid
the process...
style, you thought you'd like
yeah,
get a cool suit
first,
that you could walk through Ghost Matter later.
Exactly. Or that you can, you know, you'll get something that lets you like take two pictures at once or something that lets you hold things in place. Mm-hmm. Where really it's just teaching you a mechanic. And when I figured that out, it was actually also when I figured out that the game was never going to give me anything. And that helped me kind of unlock something about the game. Oh, okay, this is all just knowledge. One thing you said about the Brittle Hollow that's really cool is how, yeah, I don't remember exactly what it is, but I think it's the Black Hole Forge. You can access it via this little tiny cave that's just in a little river, like a frozen river that's
frozen
north. Mm-hmm. And you can just get there from the beginning of the game if you know how to do it. You could start a new save. It reinforces for me, I guess, the fact that you spend all this time getting somewhere and then the game shows you, oh, there was just a little like easily
little
hidden
shortcut.
Little door that's a shortcut. And it was always there. It isn't even like Dark Souls or whatever where you pull a lever and then the door opens. It was just there. And mm-hmm. so the very first time you played the game, if you knew what to do, you could just fly through the whole thing and do an entire sequence and like get a perfect ending if you really knew what you were doing.
But there's no
and
way you ever
that's
could.
That's really cool.
Because I remember I went to the Ash Twin core or whatever, and I think that's where the warp core is. And I like didn't know what it was because I didn't know I needed to get it. So I just like flew past it and was like, I don't know what that is. And,
so
like,
there is one thing, actually, you have to get the coordinates. Even if you like somehow lucked into not only getting the core, but like bringing it to the right place, you still wouldn't have the coordinates to.
I mean, I'm not saying you could luck into it. I mean, with the knowledge, you could start a new game and on the mm-hmm. very first time through, just blast through everything and get the perfect ending. Yeah. There's no way that you could do it without knowing, even by luck.
No, like, but so that's
a million monkeys on a million computers in a million rooms still would not. Would not arrive at the ending
but
of this
that's,
game.
But that's the one cheating thing like that breaks the rules because it actually puts the coordinates up on your screen when you're doing the navigation thing with the ship mm-hmm. if you've already discovered them. So that's the one place where like finding something will give you a little benefit. I'm glad you got to appreciate its brilliance. Let's talk about the ending because that is like some of the most... that's the reason to play the game is to get that incredible ending. What did you make of it, Maddie, of all the instruments and the band getting, I assume you
I
found
it.
All of the people. And so
I
they
did,
all showed
you
up
find
you.
All the people in the woods. I mean, so the ending is actually that you find the eye of the universe and then you mm-hmm. like enter it and then you enter this weird quantum area. It's like super spooky. And eventually you get to this forest where there's, instead of stars lighting up, there's like all these little galaxies lighting up in the air that are like evaporating into nothingness.
So that's like the most beautiful part of the game for me. I was like, holy shit during that part.
It's really awe-inspiring. Amazing. And so then you eventually, I can't remember what order it happens in. because I played it last week, but you see yourself at one point, like you run into yourself. I don't know if that happened to you guys. I was looking online at like other people's endings, and like apparently you don't always get the same thing. I don't know if you guys knew this, but
yeah, that sounds familiar. I'm pretty sure that happened.
Yeah, so like you can run into yourself and you can like walk around yourself in like a weird circle because yourself mm-hmm. will copy you. So there's like this weird quantum positioning thing happening. I don't know anything about quantum physics, but all right. So, but if you try to go up to yourself, you can't do it, and it'll just like turn into some other image. And then eventually, like the fire from the beginning of the game will appear, and like I think their name's Esker, and then they are like, oh, you have to find everybody else. And it's like, I interpreted it as your own memories or something like that, as opposed to like an actual like quantum recreation of the other aliens actually being there with you. I saw it more as just like, by this point, you know you're going to die and that the universe is going to end. And at least that's how I felt about the game, was that just, you know that the sun is going to explode no matter what. And you're just getting to the eye of the universe, and then it happens and the Big Bang happens.
Well, and you've removed the core, so there's right. no more time loop.
So you know you're not going to go back again. So you're just sort of living in your own memories in that moment, and you're like finding all the other explorers who like were playing their own songs, which is how you found them. You find them through these songs that they play, and you like bring them all back to the campfire with you. And then you sort of realize that all the songs go together, which is something that I knew anyway. I just was like, oh, they're all in the same key. Like, that's really cool. Like, this game has like a lot of overlapping tunes that you can hear. But then at the very end, they all come together, and you can like start each person's song in a row and listen to them all. And I cried, and I was excited and happy that all my friends were together, even though I was also like, I think this is only in my mind, and I don't think this is real. I think this is just my character having a memory of all the explorers finally being together at the end of everything. And then you like leap into this glowing sphere, and then there's a Big Bang. And
it's interesting because it's interesting that you felt like it was all leading to death, because at that point I felt,
you didn't think
the game, I mean, I think the game subverts your expectations a little bit, at least it did for me, in that I thought like, oh, it's a video game. There's going to be some way to save the universe. And like, if I find what the Nomai were looking for in the eye, then I'll figure out why this signal was calling out to them and figure out how to stop this from happening.
Right. But,
and there's something kind of beautiful in the fact that the ending asks you to like accept the inevitability of death and just try to live your best life at the end of things. And then like, maybe there will be hope in the future. If we don't all just like destroy everything on the way, if we play some music on the way out, then our lives will have been worth living.
Yeah.
I like your read, Maddie. I agree. I felt pretty similarly. Like that was about my read on it. Though, you know, it's really ambiguous, and it's left very ambiguous. Things that don't seem ambiguous to me are, like you said, Jason, that it ends, you know, the sun goes supernova. You don't stop the sun from going supernova, and that was never the point. Mm-hmm. I like that there is this brief sort of vignette through the museum that you find
right,
at the very beginning of the
yeah.
game. And
that's
it, so and cool. it just explains to you what happens. But what is explained to you, one of them is the Nomai are a race that lived in our solar system. We don't know why they died.
No, wait a minute. No, it doesn't say that. No, when I clicked it, it might change depending on what you've discovered, because when I clicked it, it was like they died when the comet set off all the ghost matter, and the ghost matter killed them all.
Oh, interesting. Well, yeah, then I guess I got a different ending, which I thought was really cool. I loved that it just said, we don't know why they died, and maybe that was just because I didn't learn it, but there is a sort of...
Did you get into the middle of the comet, the interloper?
And just yeah, did you wait for it to melt and like go inside the comet?
Oh, no, I never did.
Oh, shit.
This is so interesting.
Okay, so yeah. So inside the comet, you discover the source of the ghost matter, and it's clear. And you learn the story about like the people who landed on the comet and they got inside of it. And this is totally unnecessary to beat the game, as you saw. But like, yeah, then at the end, it'll say that you do know why they died.
So that's cool, because I like my ending. I liked that we didn't know why they died, that there was just sort of like, well, we didn't learn that, and then we kept going. Like, it's actually really cool that they wrote that in and made that one of the possible endings you can get. It makes me want to go learn about the other endings, I guess. But also,
I'm sure all the info just changes based on what you've discovered.
What you have,
just like,
yeah.
So, yeah, at the end,
but like to see how many variables there are. Well, so, but my broader point is that, like, it also doesn't matter because the ending is this just big, beautiful explosion, basically. Yeah. And that's kind of what really matters in the end. Like, I think that that is, I don't know, I'm all about ambiguity in endings. And so often, it's like the opposite of Westworld, right? This is the Westworld problem, was that they began having a million little mysteries that they solved every single
puzzles.
One of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the ending was, like, going to come together in this perfect thing where this game, so much of the game is learning and assembling knowledge and building this perfect little collection of information. But then at the end, like you said, Jason, they subvert that, the expectation that you're gonna solve everything and like save the world. Mm-hmm. And actually you don't. And you're thrown into this very, you know, ambiguous and weird quantum space where everything is sort of existing at the same time and also not existing at the same time. And then there's just a beautiful song and then everything ends. And that's wonderful. Like, holy shit. You know, like that's, it's just operating on a level of sort of artistic beauty that very mm-hmm. few video games do.
So I assume both of you guys got to the moon, the quantum moon, and met Solanum. That to me was the coolest moment, just like being like, holy shit, there is a Nomai in front of me, and the way that you communicate with him by like moving really the cool. stones and just like figuring out all the different permutations. It was so like, yeah, that was super satisfying for me, just having to like mix and match all the different rocks to like communicate with him.
Seeing one of them was cool, and you know, they were at the ending as well. And I think like one of the shortcomings of the game narratively is keeping track of all the characters who are speaking. Like that for me was very difficult. I'm assuming it was for you both too, just because
it could have been a better log.
There could have been some way of at least like an outline portrait or some way of associating a visual shape or something with each character, because I just couldn't keep the names straight. And I'm sure you can, and I did keep track of their general narratives and their personality quirks and, you know, their relationships to one another. But there were so many times where I was like, I just can't remember who's who. And seeing one of the, you know, one of the Nomai was just cool. And I wished I had had that connection with all of the characters, because they're all really well written. And I like their relationships and their general sort of can-do approach to things and their enthusiasm and their humor. But I didn't feel like I knew who was talking. And that did strike me as like a shortcoming of the game.
Yeah. If there had been voice acting, I feel like that would have really changed it, like possibly for the better. But I know that's just not the kind of game it was. It's a very simple game in some ways. Not that many people made it. But I would have liked hearing some audio logs instead of just reading. Not that I don't like reading, but it would have
been kind of neat. Voices would have been true to it, because they didn't communicate with
alien language. Yeah, I don't know. It wouldn't
have. Well, they didn't speak at all. They communicated through this writing. I think that's like what the idea is that they don't actually talk to each other, which is an interesting,
That's
this
why
is literally
how my rights on the wall when you're talking to them.
Yeah.
There's some other way that even if they didn't do voice acting to make it easier.
Yeah.
To
or like musical cues characters. Or something to sort of remind you who different characters were besides just their names. Cause there are also so many Nomai characters that you hear from. I mean, that's kind of cool. It gives you the sense that this really was like a huge race of people who all had different opinions about how to go forward. And like, they have sort of political arguments about whether the Sun Station should exist and all these things. And I enjoyed reading all of it, but there are just so many different characters that I was like, I can't remember who any of them are.
Yeah, man, just a perfect game. So, yeah, some of the most enjoyable moments.
That's Jason's takeaway from the recent digression we just had about one of the game's most significant flaws is, just a perfect.
It's perfect.
If the only complaint you can voice is that, like, it's kind of hard
Jason,
to keep track of the characters.
I mean, Jason, you know I have other complaints. There are just many things about the game it's just a difficult game.
Let me preface that by saying, in my perspective, it is a perfect game. No,
it's exactly the kind of game you like. That's fair.
But I'm just thinking of some other highlights, getting to the bottom of Giant's Deep. I think a lot of solving the big puzzles, like figuring out how to get into the jellyfish and then into the middle of Giant's Deep. For me, finally figuring out the Ash Twin thing was pretty cool. Although Maddie, you kind of stumbled onto that, which is another cool way of doing it. Getting to the Sun Station was super cool, and figuring out how to use the transporter and being like, oh yeah, I should do it this way. Are there any other favorite moments for you guys?
Yeah, the when I realized the fact that the game makes time, like the time movement of time, into a mechanic that you have to navigate is really cool. And the coolest one for me
Majora's
was the
Mask
way
style.
Yeah, and the way that the wall that you need to access in the Brutal Hollow collapses into the black hole and then falls and is available floating through space at the black hole station on the other end. The fact that that happens and you just have to wait long enough and then they'll just come warping through and then you can just fly your ship up and read what you need to read. That to me was like really, really cool. When I figured that out, I was like, oh, of course, the planet's falling into the, and it was this just great moment of sort of every part of the game coming together into a really cool solution. So I like that a lot.
Agreed.
Yeah, I really liked figuring out that you can go into the satellite, because I just went into the black hole so many times and ended up in the white hole, and when I finally figured out I could get back without just dying, I was really excited about it. I was like, oh, I can just take this little teleporter that's inside of this satellite that's way out in space, and I can just get back. Thank God.
The super clever thing about that is that, like, I think the way they designed it, it feels like that's meant to teach you, because
how
you're probably
going to
stumble upon
yeah.
that before you figure out the secrets of Ash Twin. So yeah, that's like meant to teach you how to use that.
In theory, it would have, but I'm still kind of a dumbass and didn't fully figure out how teleports worked until, like, I don't know, the end. I even now I couldn't really tell you how they work.
It's a little funky.
Well, so the way it works
fiction.
Is that well the way it works is that if the when the planet is hovering directly above what the teleporter, and you're standing on the teleporter, then it teleports you.
Right.
And so
yeah, but there's like a little squirreliness
to it. It breaks its own
it.
Logic like, with Ash Twin, because you have to be standing, like when Ember Twin is above you, if you're standing in the Ash Twin teleporter, it takes you inside of Ash Twin. So it's kind of,
well,
kind of
that's
playing with the
not
rules
not really
there.
Teleportation. It's just using the sand falling to propel.
No. It's supposed to be teleporting you. Yeah, it's a tele... So
well,
the way the
sure.
teleporter rule is that... And it says this in the White Hole Station, like when the celestial body that you're teleporting to is directly overhead.
Right,
that's
right.
When
that's
you get
true.
Teleported.
It does say that. Yeah, you're
so
right.
So that's the case for every teleporter in the game. And so I guess the logic is to get inside of Ash Twin, it counts Ember Twin as like the same celestial entity. So in order to get inside of Ash Twin, Ember Twin has to be overhead, right? So that's why it's teleporting.
My understanding of that puzzle actually was that there needs to be a second tower, because the tower is what channels it, and the column of sand functions as a tower just for that one moment,
right,
when it's standing
the tower
there,
is broken,
and that activates the teleporter that then fires you into the inside. The one thing that I just want to say is that I enjoy that in talking about this game, I've learned new things. Like, I learned the thing about the about
the
meteor.
Comet.
I feel like I hope that everybody who plays this game has friends they can talk about the game with, because that alone is a really cool part of it. Like, it's so much better to be able to give your friends hints on things in this game and to then just have a conversation about your process and how you figured things out, because there's so many different orders you can do things in, and that is, like, the most rewarding part of the game, I think. And, like, the whole time I was playing it, I wanted nothing more than to talk with you guys or with whoever, like, talk to people about the game, because I kept thinking, this is so cool. And, you know, Googling is dangerous, because you might find
a spoiler,
you know, an answer
for
you didn't want. Or
yeah.
Right. So that alone is a special aspect of this game.
Did you guys get onto Hollow Lantern, which is the little satellite planet, little moon that spits fire?
I maybe landed
Brittle
on
Hollow.
It once.
I don't think so.
Okay, so if you get on there, you can actually find, there's like one area that you could find, and you find a little piece of Nomai text. And the Nomai text talks about how they need to be careful. It talks about how they built Ash Twin using the rocks from what's it called? The starting Timber Hearth, the starting planet. So they built, you know, those mines in the starting planet. That's where they dug up all those rocks and used them to build. They sent them through the teleporters and used them to build the core of Ash Twin. But the Hollow Lantern text also talks about them being like really set, like heat, like melting under heat. If you put enough heat to them, they might melt. And so that fucked with me for a long time, because I thought that that was the secret to getting inside of Ash Twin, because this was
funny.
It was hinting.
Oh,
it was like
funny.
Too much information.
So I was like, okay, how am I going to get fire onto Ash Twin? And I was like trying to figure out all these different ways of going about it. And I had a similar problem.
Funny.
I had a similar problem with the jellyfish, because I didn't realize that there were jellyfish underwater. And the only jellyfish. Once I saw the jellyfish hint on Dark whatever, on the Bramblefish terrifying planet.
Mm-hmm. The worst planet.
Dark Bramble. Yeah,
once I saw that hint from what's-his-face, Feldspar gave me that hint, I went to Giant Steep, and the only jellyfish I could find was the planet where Feldspar had been like researching.
Mm-hmm. And there's like a dead one there, right?
And there's a dead one frozen in ice. And for a while I was like, oh, okay, I must have to get this out of the ice. And so I thought there was a way to do that. And I was like, so I was batting my head against that wall for a little while. So yeah, the game took me a long time to finish because I kept going on all these false leads and thinking, like trying to outsmart things or thinking too much about these things. All right, so we should wrap things up because we have been talking for a while. So why don't we take another break and then we'll get through some off-topic stuff.
Sounds good.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we are back. Let's get through some off-topic stuff real quick before we say goodbye. Maddie, why don't you start us off? Tell us about what you've been doing outside of video games.
Sure. It's not much. I was away for a lot of this weekend, and I went whitewater rafting with my girlfriend and my parents, and it was really, really fun. And
nice.
Kurt just did that too. Didn't you guys both?
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit. That wasn't actually the inspiration for it. I had been wanting to take her whitewater rafting anyway for a long time. No, she's a big fan of kayaking, and she'd never been. So I was just like, this is perfect. We gotta make it happen. It's so fun. I super recommend it as an activity.
Did she sit in the front?
She did. We sat side by side in the front and got to be front of the pictures because that's how that works. They take pictures of you as you go. Oh, it's great. So that was fun. And I wasn't home watching TV or playing games because I was doing that. But we did watch a little bit of Glow. Season 3 is out, but she wasn't all caught up on it. And it's a great show. So we've just been rewatching it together. I really like that show. It's good.
Yeah. I watched the first episode of season 3, but Emily's out of town this week, so I'm waiting. Mm-hmm. But I liked the first episode because I like that show, and they're all fun actors to watch. So.
Yeah, very much
It's on my list. It's on my list. My next show, have you guys watched Mindhunter? That's next on my list.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen season one. I haven't seen season two
I'm psyched for season
yet.
Two.
Okay, yeah, I gotta watch that. It's good. I'm very curious about that. So I have been watching a bunch more of Billions, which I think really hit its stride in season 2. Like, season 1 was good, but it wasn't until there's this one episode that I texted you, Maddie, about directly after it happened. There's this episode called like Golden Frog or something, and it just blew my mind. It's like one of the top episodes of TV.
It's like a super twisty episode where like at the end all is revealed. It's one of those. Yeah. They do a bunch of those going forward, and they're the best kinds of Billions episodes.
Yeah, this show has really, really like taken off and now understands what it wants to be. And now my wife and I have watched a ton over the past couple of weeks and gotten mostly through season 3. And in season 3,
that doesn't surprise me at all, because that was how I was about that show when the first 3 seasons came out. I just like plummeted downhill into all of it.
Man, well, season 3, it's getting really interesting because like things have changed in a big way. I don't want to spoil it, but like it feels like the whole premise of the show is changing as a result of the events of the middle that resolve not just at the end of season 3, like in the middle of season 3. So yeah, I'm very, very hooked by that show and very excited to keep watching that. We're almost on to season 3 now. And then I just finished reading this book called Home Game by Michael Lewis. Michael Lewis is a journalist, one of my favorite authors, wrote The Big Short and Moneyball and many other things. And this book is kind of this like, it's this tiny collection of vignettes about his parenting life and what a bad parent he is, which I thought would be an appropriate thing for me to read about. And I kind of need to give it to my wife and have her read it just to appreciate what my future parenting will be a lot more, because this is a good book for all the husbands out there to share with their spouses to make their spouses appreciate their own parenting more, because it's all about what a bad parent he is.
That's funny.
And yeah, that's it for me. Kirk, what about you?
Well, let's see. I watched a documentary about the Heaven's Gate cult. I have a group of friends and we watch cult documentaries together. We're called Classic Cults. And we watched this documentary.
You call yourself Classic Cults? Yeah, you have a club name.
Oh, yeah. Don't your clubs have names? Your clubs have to have a name. Oh, man, of course.
All right, yeah, I'll work on it.
Are you guys like the Murderheads in Veronica Mars?
No, we're not like the Murderheads in Veronica Mars. Okay. We're just a group of friends who enjoy watching cult documentaries because they're fascinating. So this was about the Heaven's Gate documentary, which are the sort of UFO slash God and Jesus. It's like a mix of those things, sort of cult.
They're the Kool-Aid people, right?
No, that's, well, it was Flavor Aid and that was Jonestown. But these people did, it was a suicide cult. So it was 39 people. And I think 1997, they saw the Hale-Bopp comet as like a sign that it was time to depart this realm and go to the next one. It's pretty chilling stuff. This documentary was actually very bad. It's on Amazon, and it was bad both. It was very badly made, like laughably badly made, which is always a little bit instructive to watch a badly made documentary. It seemed almost like a school project or something at times.
Weird.
But it was very strange. It was just very strangely made. And as a result of them interviewing mostly people who still believed in the leader, dude.
Yeah.
Especially because this belief structure is, you know, the cult's belief structure was centered around the idea that like your body's just a vehicle, you depart your vehicle, and it's like a suicide cult. It was really irresponsible, actually. Like watching it by the end, I was basically thinking that this documentary is like not just badly made, but actually irresponsible. So,
and like advocating for the cult, perhaps unintentionally.
Just letting these people just talk about this over and over again. I'm like, this is like a really like damaging viewpoint, and these people killed themselves, and it's really pretty messed up. So like all cult things, it's both interesting and also pretty fucked up and, you know, troubling.
That kind of reminds me of the podcast Crime Town that I talked about a while back.
Yeah, yeah.
Which had a similar problem.
We both got to the same point, I think in the same episode, right? Uh-huh. Where we both were like, this is like just glorifying these guys who beat the shit out of people for like innocent people for money. This isn't cool. Yeah. Yeah. They kind of cross the line. It's not exactly like that, but it's a similar issue. Yeah. There's just not enough of the objective voice of like the documentarian in there. It's just a lot of people talking about some pretty damaging stuff. So anyways, but we did watch that. Still an interesting story. Then we went and watched like regular journalistically produced stuff on YouTube about Heaven's Gate to actually learn more about it. And you know, cults are interesting. So there's that. I've been watching Succession. I've watched a lot more Succession.
Yes. You've been texting about it. It makes me so happy they're watching it.
Oh man. Yeah. My way of summing it up is it's like having a nightmare that's also somehow really entertaining, like each episode. Uh-huh. Oh my Lord, what an entertaining show. It's great. It's so stressful. Holy shit.
Do you remember my first reaction when I was talking about it? I was like, this is like, I don't know if this is great or horrible or amazing, or like it's really well made.
It's really good. I mean, the people making the show are not fucking around, and they definitely know what they're doing. They have so the characters of Tom and Cousin Greg are like these two characters. I won't get into a ton of specifics on this, but like those two characters make it extremely clear to me, like the humor that is in like used against those characters, the way that the show mocks them is so sharp. I mean, Jesus, like every scene that I'm watching, I'm just sitting there like kind of just cowering and laughing at like how, oh my God, Tom is like the most amazing TV character ever. But the thing that it strikes me so far, so I'm like seven episodes in,
have you gotten to the bachelor party episode yet?
Yes. I just watched that. I have two episodes left in the first season. And holy jeez, man. But like also the takeover episode, like the vote of no comp. Oh my, like don't even, Jesus. Anyways, overarching thought on this show that I find is the most admirable and interesting thing about this show is that, and this actually goes back to what Maddie, you were telling me about Billions a couple weeks ago, I think. This show, more than anything else I've ever seen that's about ultra-rich, powerful people, it is like anti-glorification at every moment. Every shot in the show is like claustrophobic. Every room is both really expensive looking, but like either cold and shitty looking in a certain way, or like really tacky and tasteless, the design of the people. The characters are all miserable, and they're all kind of ghouls. Like there's just enough humanity in some of them to make you care about who they are as people, but they're really ghouls, and a lot of the pleasure of the show is like watching them just eat shit and like have stuff fall apart, because they're all horrible people, and you know, Led, the patriarch of this family, is like this awful, awful person. It's the first time in a while watching a show that is about extremely wealthy, like billionaire, the super rich. At no point in the show ever do you feel like, wow, I'd love to be there, or wow, that's like a really amazing party they're at, or that building they're in is so beautiful. Like, they're all driven everywhere. They have drivers, they have servants, they have like all of that, but it never looks fun. It's like wretched at every moment, and the show is definitely doing that on purpose. And in that way, it feels super of the time. Like, it's very, very, oh man, it's really something else. Like, it is, I watch it through my fingers half the time, but it's a great show. So I do like it, and it's very funny. It's like got the sharpest and darkest sense of humor of a show I've seen in a while, but wow, it's good. So anyways, that's Succession. I'm sure I'll have more thoughts when I finish it and watch the new season, which is ongoing. And then just really quickly, I started the Amazon show The Boys, which a couple of listeners wrote to ask what we thought of that. This is a show that's like an anti-superhero show where essentially the superheroes are the bad guys, and it's about, it's like another, it's very like modern Watchmen meets kind of the vibe of Kick-Ass. Like, it's based on a comic series. I don't know. I'm mixed on it. It's really clever in some ways and sort of fun to watch, but it's also very got that kind of really cynical, like it's a really cynical show, and I'm waiting for the kind of heart to come through, and there are moments of heart. So I don't know. I watched some of it. I might watch more. It's entertaining, I guess, but I'm medium on it. So when I take breaks from the stress of Succession, I've watched a few episodes of that show, and I'll probably watch a few more. And there could come a point where I'm like, ah, this just isn't exactly doing it for me, and I might stop. So that's kind of where I'm at on The Boys, and that's cool. That's it for me.
All right, let's finish things off with some Muzak. Kirk, give us your pick of the week.
Okay, so my music pick is from the new Strong Songs as a Listener Q&A. People wrote in about a whole bunch of songs. One of the most fun questions actually was, does the instructions that Marty McFly gives to the band in Back to the Future, would the band actually be able to play Johnny B. Goode based on those instructions? So if you want to know the answer to that and hear me nitpick a classic movie, listen to that episode.
Well, wait, let me interrupt by saying the episode before that, you did TV animated shows, and I was just listening to you talk about the Simpsons theme song on the subway yesterday and just grinning the whole time. It was very enjoyable.
Nice. Cheers. Yeah, that was a really fun episode. It's nice to do these Q&A episodes are like easier in some ways just because you can kind of jump from thing to thing. But one of the questions was about how to count Pyramid Song, which is from Radiohead song from their 2001 album Amnesiac. And the counting on this song is super wild. You have to listen to the episode for it. I tweeted this. I made this like infographic that's supposed to explain how it's like the sequence of 3-3-4-3-3 and eighth notes are like 3-2-3 and quarter notes that kind of forms a pyramid. It's like 3-3 with a 4 on top and then 3 on the other side. And it's like pyramids within pyramids in Pyramid Song. And I got this whole thing on it and tried to make an infographic that looks like something that like the Secret Hunters of Destiny would make to try to figure out a vault secret. It's like this ludicrous, I think probably not helpful infographic. Anyways, the song is really cool on its own. I hadn't listened to it in a long time, and like I spent forever figuring out like how I thought they were feeling it. And it's a cool tune from a really cool album. I have this like, I'm just, Radiohead is really amazing. I have like a new appreciation for them since recently breaking down some of their songs. So here is a clip of Pyramid Song from Amnesiac. Jumps into I'm sure everyone listening was like, oh, I counted that the first time. No problem.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, piece of cake. 3-3-4-3-3.
They're all drummers. Only drummers listen to this show.
Yeah, only drummers. yeah, man. Radiohead, though. What a cool band.
I like imagining you just in your room with like pieces of red string trying
Straight up. Charlie from Always Sunny. I was like yelling and drawing triangles and triangles and triangles and like writing 3-3-4-3-3 over and over and over again.
But you were also listening to the YouTube video of the drummer doing the drum selection to that monologue. Have you ever seen that?
Yes. Oh, man. Yeah. That guy who does the like jazz drums.
Just to really get in the mode drum wise.
Yep. 100%. Definitely.
All right. All you drummers out there, it's time to say goodbye. So drum your way out of this episode. Kirk, Maddie, it's been fun. I'll see you guys next week.
Yep. See you all next week.
Bye.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Kirk Hamilton, Jason Schreier, and me, Maddie Myers. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're a part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR One, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. And we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.